We'll go for the ones on the bottom first today, so that those who didn't have their questions asked yesterday have their questions asked first. Okay, here we go. Let's see how many we can get done today. Okay, here we go. The first question I have on here. Only when opportunity arises, I attend retreats such as this one, and hardly set time to do meditation amidst family life and work commitments. Just attending meditation retreats, will I be able to achieve anything or progress? Should we set aside 30 minutes for meditation every day? When is the best time of the day for working adults? Like obviously, the more meditation you can do, just the stronger your mind will be. The nice way of looking at meditation is calling it food for the heart. Just as you have food for the body, you also need food for your heart as well. And meditation is a way of giving that food for the heart. And the meditation retreat is very nice to be able to do. But if you can do some meditation regularly, you'll find that, you know, your heart, your mind gets stronger and stronger. And you know that it's important to have a strong, healthy heart. Because sometimes the stress, the disappointments, the pace of modern life is such, if one isn't strong and fit in the heart, sometimes we get the sicknesses, such as anger is like a sickness of the heart, such as like the bickering speech, such as disharmony, such as a lack of forgiveness. And eventually that sort of gives rise to worry and guilt. These are all sicknesses of the heart. If you give yourself good health food for the heart, like meditation, you find those sicknesses, they can't last, even if they come at all. And of course you have the other sicknesses, like, you know, depression, lack of self-esteem, all those things. Always comes very often because the heart isn't very strong. So it's important to do meditation, just as it is important to eat. And when people ask me, in general, you're a working person, how long should you spend meditating every day? And the answer is about the same time you spend eating every day. That's a good rule of thumb. So if you spend a lot of time eating, spend a lot of time meditating, because it's food for the heart. And the best time of the day is really whenever you can find the time. If you really want to, you can find the time. Sometimes, because of our lifestyle, sometimes it can be easier to do it early in the morning, just to get up half an hour earlier and meditate, because that time the children and the husband or the wife is still in bed, when you can actually do a bit of meditation. In the evening, sometimes you have to socialize, sometimes the kids are running up and down, so sometimes the evening is perhaps not the best time. Early in the morning is a great time, but basically whatever time you can find. Dear Ajahn, can you do a demonstration on walking meditation? This is my feet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You walk naturally. You don't walk the way I walked. You don't walk the way other people walked. You just walk naturally. Just as you were walking to breakfast, or you're walking to your room at the end of the day, you walk that way. So don't force the walk and make it any different than you usually do. And you don't have to do it fast or slow, just keep it natural. There are sometimes that some monks walk very fast and some monks walk very slow. As for me, I do both. There are times when I really feel I need to get some energy going, and so I just walk quite fast. There's other times it's so cool, so peaceful, you just can't walk fast even if you wanted to. Just walk so slowly. But that's when it's natural. I never force the pace of my walking meditation. It just goes so natural. So don't look at the person next to you and have a race, like a reverse race, to see who can go slowest. You feel like, they're going too fast, I can go slower than them. Don't play games like that. Just walk your natural pace and just be mindful of the walking meditation. As I said yesterday, first of all, just be mindful of the present moment. The fact that there is no time, that's just a delusion. You're just here in this moment, in Club Med Ippo, just enjoying yourself. Just enjoying every moment, just being here. And here you're being here, just walking. And when you think about it, it's just it's amazing, it's wonderful. You've got nothing you have to do. No one is going to give you a report card after this retreat and grade you A, B, C, D, E, or F. This is not like an exam at a school. Everybody passes. Everybody gets the best mark, the highest mark. Just because you come here, that's enough for you to graduate with full honors. So there's no comparison, there's no judging. So that way, you just in this moment, you don't have to do anything. Isn't this wonderful? For once in life, you don't have to live up to anybody's expectations. You don't have to achieve something. You don't have to get anywhere. You don't have to write a report about it afterwards. There's absolute freedom. And if you're just really sleepy, you just go and have a rest. Even that's allowed. Anything is allowed. It's just amazing. I don't have to do anything here. Oh, this is so great. All the pressures are just taken off you. So when you're walking, just be so grateful to walk without any burdens. You're not having to carry around any worries from the past or any plans for the future. You can walk just free like a dancer. It's so light from worries, duties, concerns. Oh, isn't this great? You just need to walk, that's all. It's one foot at a time. One step at a time, that's all you need to think about. Isn't this great, this amount of freedom you have? With no burdens, nothing to worry about. So do that, present moment awareness. And then eventually you stop thinking. It's just so nice to be free. I'm just walking. I'm not going anywhere. When I get to the end, I turn around and come back again. Just like samsara. You start off as a baby. You end up as a baby. With somebody, you put nappies on when you get old. And someone has to clean you up. You start off on four legs when you're crawling, your two arms or your two spare legs. When you get old, you need the two more legs, your two walking sticks. Oh, sorry. You start with four legs and you end up with four legs. The baby and an old person. So you all go around in circles. So because of that, just when you're walking, just walk with no burdens at all. And enjoy the freedom of having nothing to do, nowhere to go, no burdens, nothing to carry around. Oh, isn't this great? Freedom at last. So walk in freedom. Next question here, why is noble silence important during a retreat? Do you think that if the yogis form groups to discuss about their progress, would it be a good idea? Please enlighten, thank you very much. You know, we do too much talking already. And if we start talking about our progress, then we get into these competition games and egos and who's doing the best and who's doing the worst. And also, it's not really the time to make assessments. This is the time just to be alone and to be free. When I say alone, we're alone together. Because even though that we're not talking to each other, you do actually find that if you have a good meditation, everyone else's meditation gets brought along with the current of your deep meditation. We do affect each other here, you know, in a very deep way. So yeah, I mean, you are by yourself, but you are also together. Instead of communicating with words, we communicate with loving kindness. Just the fact that when you get up, you're very careful not to brush against the person sitting next to you or behind you. Very careful not to make a noise. And that degree of care and sensitivity to the other people who are sharing this retreat with you, that is actually how we relate to each other. That is how we communicate. You don't have to communicate in words. In fact, you're far more sensitive. You can communicate so more deeply just with silence, just with a gaze of kindness, just with gently moving out of the way to let someone else go in front of you. Those are beautiful ways of communicating, because what you're saying is, I recognize you, I respect you, I care for you. What better communication can there be than that? So we can keep it quiet, because when we start talking, it starts off with one word, and then it becomes a sentence, and then it becomes a paragraph. And after a while, it's yak, 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 yak. And if you ever notice, everybody wants to talk, but very few people want to listen. So here you're learning how to listen by being absolutely silent. After a while, on this noble silence. It's something which supports the inner silence. Just you realize you don't need to speak to express yourself. You find that you don't need to think in order to know what's going on. And after a while, when that thinking disappears, you find you see and know much more about life than you could ever know through thinking about it. You find like bare knowledge, bare feeling is so much closer to reality in the world of thoughts, words and descriptions. And after a while you realize just how limited are these words, how they're just approximations at best, and they can never capture the truth and reality of what you're experiencing. Even the best poets only come close at best to what's really happening. And after a while of silence, you realize you don't need to describe it. You realize you can never describe what you're feeling. You can come close, but you can never make it accurate. But you can know, you can feel. And in that silence, again, there's a lot of freedom. Sometimes it's just such a stress to try and explain how we feel to others or to ourselves, to try and put it all into words. Here we don't need to. We just simply know and leave it at that. So again, another great burden has been taken away from you. So this is learning how to be free. And in the silence you become so more sensitive. You can hear the birds. You can hear the hum of the traffic without saying what it is. You can feel the heat or the cool of the day. And after a while you can feel the taste of the food. You feel it all, you become just alive and sensitive to whatever's happening. Because everyone is quiet. So your senses can become, can actually grow and become more subtle. So noble silence is a beautiful way of running this retreat. And what you will find, when I teach retreats in Perth, the last day I tell people, now you can talk now. It's almost like a bit of a joke I do every time. Okay, you can talk now, but nobody wants to talk. After 8 or 9 days, they love the silence so much. They're enjoying it, that, oh, I don't want to talk, be quiet. And I do that just to show just how beautiful and how wonderful, how enjoyable silence can be. Once you get into it, you don't want to throw it away. I imagine that, was it 2 or 3 days, I forget how long we've been here now, but already many of you are comfortable in the silence. You don't need to speak. It's wonderful. You can actually share the breakfast table together. And they're your friends there. You care about each other, but you don't need to say so. You don't need to say good morning, because that's known, that we wish everybody a very wonderful morning. Hope you do really well today. You can say that with your eyes. You're just being there. And after a while, you don't need to speak anymore. And you're happy not speaking. You can still care about each other. A noble silence is not just ordinary silence, it's noble silence. It's beautiful, it's wonderful. It's something which is so rare in the world, to be with so many people and be quiet. It's so rare. It's like a precious jewel. That's why when people get to know it, they value it so much, they don't want to spoil it. That's why you don't have to need, we don't need to have policemen in this retreat. We don't need to sort of hire a couple of policemen to check up on you to see whether you're talking. And if you talk, you know, to punish you. You don't need to do that, because once people get in to the silence, they love it. They enjoy it. So you're silent because you want to. It's nice. It's the best way of doing it. You can talk afterwards. But afterwards, you don't really want to talk. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if a yogi here feels there is no progress in the meditation, either mind still wanders, and it still feels drowsy, does she still need to attend interview sessions? Thank you. If you're still looking for progress, if you still want progress, then you should come to the interview sessions. If you've had the insight already, there's no progress, there's only ingress. If you have that insight already that everything is okay, it's a natural process, just shut up, be patient, and everything will be okay. Then you don't need to come to the interviews. All the interviews is giving a little bit of encouragement, saying, carry on, it's all going well. Just wait. It's all going to happen. Just take time, be patient. One of the biggest problems of people on a meditation retreat is impatience. They want to get enlightened now. Look, think about it. If you get enlightened, what are you going to do for the rest of the week? So don't do it now. Give it till later. So in other words, be patient and be content. The idea of progress, that's the problem. Because we think we're going to get somewhere, go somewhere. Meditation is very subtle. It goes in a different direction to the world. Be content where you are. Just give up all craving, all destinations, all trying to get somewhere, all trying to make it different. And be more appreciative of what you have now. Gratitude for this moment. And gratitude for yourself. Not looking at your faults, but seeing just how wonderful you are. How wonderful that you've managed to get here. And you're keeping these 8 precepts, sitting on your cushion just meditating. If the Buddha was here, he'd bow down before you and say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's enough. What happens next is when you're content, when you stop all this striving, then you don't go anywhere. Energies of the mind just build up naturally. And eventually the mindfulness gets so strong. You're not dull, but you're not restless. You're just here. Here, more alive, more alert than you've ever been before. And so happy and so peaceful. Simply because the cause of unpeace, the cause of the lack of stillness, this wanting, this doing, thinking you've got to get somewhere, progress, comparing, measuring, all of that has been taken away. My first meditation teacher used to say, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. Oh, what a great teaching that is. There's no such thing as a bad meditation. The very fact you're sitting, it means it's good. I mean, it's excellent. So no such thing as a bad meditation. Just be patient, you're just building up the energy, building up the steam, you're putting credit in the bank. And after a while, you have so much credit, the bank will send you a letter, giving you first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, whatever it is. It just happens. Just carry on in the moment. Don't try and get anywhere. Don't look for the next moment. Just be more content with what's happening now. As I said last night, whether you're in a prison or in a monastery, if you're happy to be here, you feel this incredible freedom. So be happy if you're sleepy. If you're restless, be content with that restlessness. It's just part of the progress, that's all. Leave it alone. Don't struggle, don't be upset. And then you'll find the whole process just goes so smoothly. So you're on the flight, it's going to Nirvana, just sit down. As they say when I go on these aircraft, they say, the flight is going to go to KLIA, sit down and enjoy the in-flight service. Not the in-flight service, the in-flight service. That's what happens, you sit down and just enjoy the in-flight service. Just like in the plane, all these flight attendants, they come and give you things. They come and serve you. What do you want? What do you want to drink, Ajahn Brahm? We've got wine, we've got Johnny Walker. I say, be quiet, I'll have an orange juice, I'm a monk. So they come and offer you all these things. This is what happens in meditation. You sit down there, you make yourself peaceful and quiet, and then all this, the Buddha comes to serve you, all these amazing insights. Have Anicca, Dukkha, do you want Anatta today? And it comes to you, it's amazing just what happens. So just make the mind peaceful and quiet and it all comes. Dear Ajahn, the path to enlightenment is a long journey. Compare it to, say, Christianity. If you believe in the Jesus and you do good, you go to heaven. Is enlightenment and heaven the same? Okay, but there's so many teachings and so many promises. Some of the promises are real, some of them aren't real. I didn't, even when I was a young man, I thought, that doesn't make any sense to me. The law of karma is like a law of justice. It doesn't matter if you say you believe in the Buddha, Jesus, or whatever. Someone has done some really mean things. The law of karma, there's a natural justice there. Well, that has to happen. You can't, there's no corruption. And say, well, you know, I know the governor of Selangor State, so therefore if I get caught sort of speeding, I can get him to cancel the fine. That's corruption. There's a natural law there. And original Christianity accepted that natural law. The belief system in Jesus actually came afterwards. If you ever listen to the history or study the history of Christianity, you'll actually notice what we take as Christianity now is more like the teachings of Paul, not the teachings of Jesus. But you know, he starts saying things like, the meek shall inherit the earth, by their acts you shall know them. It's more like Buddhism than anything else. And how do you know when we... So, the path of enlightenment is a long journey. You don't know if it's a long journey or not. In fact, it's not a long journey. It's not even a short journey. It's a now journey. It's in this moment. How can it be long or short? It's just... It's now, that's all. As soon as you stop the journeying, going somewhere, and stay where you are, then you find what enlightenment is. And about going to heaven, my goodness, you're already in heaven. But instead of enjoying it, you're just looking somewhere else. Let's go somewhere else. And how do you know when you are enlightened? Okay, when you stop asking questions like that. Three, is chanting and meditation equally important? How do we portion it in our daily lives? Just whatever you like. You know, is rice or potatoes or bread equally important? How do we portion it in your life? Some people only eat rice, some people only eat bread, some people only eat potatoes or pasta. It's just whatever you like. Whatever you feel gives you peace and happiness. If you like to chant a lot, chant a lot. If you like to meditate a lot, meditate a lot. You apportion it yourself. In the same way, when you make your food, you find out what's the right balance for your health. And you can't compare yourself to other people. So you find out what works for you. See the next question. In the time of the Buddha, were there laypersons, devotees who attained enlightenment or became arahats? If so, did they ultimately turn to the monastics, or could they still live a layperson's life with family and jobs but perform these roles in an enlightened manner? It's a very good question. I'll probably talk more in depth about that when I give a talk, I think, on enlightenment later on. It's fascinating. What actually happens is the four stages of enlightenment. It's a stream winner. You can still go about your normal daily activities if you're a lay person, just like anybody else. But you'll be a good person, just incorruptible, just naturally moral. You won't lie, you won't cheat. You'll be a really good person. And that does not mean you won't be successful in business. In fact, usually the moral people, the good people, are more successful, especially if you look upon it in the long term. Those people who are corrupt, who take the shortcuts, they may become rich in the short term, very quick, but they lose it all very quickly. That's why the morality, the goodness, gives your business a good reputation. You become trustworthy. And of course, trust is one of the most important things you sell as a business. When you sell your product, people have to know that what you say about your product is correct, that what you charge is fair, and what you say you will do when you send that product, it will get there on time. If you have that trust, your company will get a good reputation and you'll be successful. If you try and undercut your competitors by lying, sure, you'll make a quick contract, but after a while no one will believe you anymore. You won't have much business. So, if you're a stream winner, you'll be a good person. Even like a once returner, you can still live a normal life. But once you get to the stage of non-returner, because that stage of enlightenment means that many cravings and lusts and desires are completely abandoned. And there was many cases of lay people who were non-returners in the time of the Buddha and in previous Buddha, and there's a standard description for them. First of all, they have to be celibate. Just basically, you can't have desire for sex once you get to that stage. You just can't get excited, because the sexual desires could be completely eradicated. Not only that, but you're not really into possessions anymore. This layman Gatikara, he was a potter who was a non-returner, and the way he ran his business, that he wouldn't even dig the earth because he was afraid he might destroy some beetles or worms which lived in the earth. He'd actually waited for some earth to be left over when the farmers were making the dikes in the paddy fields, or when rabbits would dig their holes, he would collect the diggings, and he'd use that to make his pots. And he wouldn't even sell those pots. He put them on a bench outside his house and say, if anybody wanted a pot, please take one. If anybody wanted to actually to leave some lentils and rice for his food, they could leave it. He wouldn't even sell anything. And that's how he got by. I always stress that, because even these days, there's like monks who sell things. And even in the time of the Buddha, you've got these beautiful lay people, non-returners, who wouldn't even sell their pots when that was their livelihood. So this is actually the purity of a person with few desires. You can take the pots you want. If you want to give me some food afterwards, fine. Just the way like monks like me give Dhamma. I can teach you the Dhamma. I don't care if you don't give me anything afterwards, if you don't even feed me. If you didn't give me any breakfast or lunch, I would still come up here and teach. Because teaching is something completely different than my livelihood. This is what Gatikara did. You can take a pot if you want. You can leave some lentils and rice if you want. And the only reason he didn't become a monk himself, because his two parents were blind and had no means of support. So even these days, when a person comes up to me and says they want to become a monk, they want to become a nun, I ask them, have you got any dependents? Is your mother and father okay? Have you got a wife and kids? Are they okay? And if they're not okay, you can't become a monk. You have to do your duties to your family first of all. If you're so irresponsible that you just leave your family in destitution, if that's the degree of your irresponsibility, you'll never make it as a monk. To be a monk, you also have to be responsible. And there was a woman who was an anagami, again celibate, not interested in money at all. And she said, what happened? This is a fascinating, just so how detached she was. She said the soldiers came and they arrested her son. They accused him of some crime he didn't commit. And in those days, being soldiers of the king, they executed him on the spot in front of his mother's eyes. She said it was amazing, it was wonderful. Even though that was my son, out of my own womb, and he was being killed right in front of me for something he never did. I never felt any anger, I never felt any hatred, or never any upset at all. My mind was so peaceful throughout. And that's the level of detachment of a non-returner. It's a very high standard. Literally, your loved one gets murdered in front of you. If you can do something, you'll do it, obviously, but if you can't, you let go. Karma. Now that's what an enlightened or next to enlightened being is like. It gives you the indications. And fully enlightened, it's very close to being anagami, but it means you've got nothing left in this world. If you're a lay man or a lay woman, I might explain this later, it's a deep point of Dhamma, but it's true. If you're a lay man or a lay woman, you get fully enlightened. You have to go and join the monastery somehow or other, because there's no other point to living a life. Otherwise, you'll just give up the life faculty. You'll just die. There's nothing to keep the life going anymore, unless it's being a monastic serving the community in the robes of a Buddha. But don't worry, it's very unlikely you become an arahat in this retreat. If you become a stream winner, that'd be wonderful. Next question. When I meditated this morning, I felt dizzy and couldn't sit through the meditation session. Should I stop or should I sit through it and observe? If you feel dizzy, just maybe just relax a bit, sit through it maybe. I don't know that sometimes, if it's a girl who wrote that, sometimes if you're part of your period, losing a bit of blood, when you have you do your meditation, sometimes your blood pressure goes down. It's natural because you relax so much, and so that could be a cause of a bit of dizziness. If it is, maybe just go back to your room and lie down for a little bit until sort of the blood pressure comes up a bit. That's all you need to do. There's so many different causes. So just be sensitive to your body. If you really think, yeah, it needs to be, go back and lie down, do so. Don't push too hard. But if you think, well, maybe it's only a little bit of dizziness, maybe I'll just relax and it'll go away, then maybe it does go away. Try a little bit, see what happens. If it doesn't go away and it gets worse, then don't take less. The dizziness doesn't last. It could be, you know, because you didn't eat last night, sometimes the sugar level might be a bit low in your blood. All sorts of different reasons. Maybe just take a sweet or something sugary and suck it. Get your sugar levels up. There's all sorts of reasons. But a lot of times you can just sit there and think, ah, who cares, I'm just going to watch. And for me, when that happens, I just become still and peaceful. It just goes away after a while. The mind is always more powerful than the body when it gets down to it. What is samadhi? Wrong and right samadhi, please explain. And what is jhana? I'm going to put that question aside because I think that's not tonight, tomorrow night. I think I'm talking about jhana. But to say what samadhi is like stillness of the mind. And you can take an object and it's just so still and you don't move. Sometimes I call it sustained attention. Sustained attention. That's like a samadhi. I don't like the word concentration because that implies too much force. The best way to sustain your attention on anything is to be able to look upon that thing with happiness and joy. Because whatever you enjoy doing, it's easy to keep your attention there. Which is what I learned as a school teacher. If you make the lesson fun and interesting, all your kids will pay attention. You don't need to wave the stick, because they only pay attention out of fear, and as soon as you go, they don't pay attention anymore. But if you use happiness and joy, then people want to pay attention. They love watching it. So, see if you can put some joy and happiness in the meditation, then it's easy to sustain attention. Or whatever you have to do in life, whatever task you're given, even if it's washing the dishes. Don't ever think, why do I have to wash the dishes? This is not fair. I don't need to wash the dishes. Put joy into it. Just see how beautifully you can wash those dishes. Just how much you can make them sparkle. Whatever it is, make it fun. Make it a game. And then when it's a game, put joy into it. It's easy to keep your attention there. And your mind doesn't wander off. Which is why I said the other day, if you're getting bored with the breath meditation, then do the backwards breathing. If you're getting really tired there, then turn around and face the other way when you're meditating. Do stupid things. Make it funny. If you're walking, and you're walking meditation and getting tired, try walking backwards. See what happens. So make it fun and games, because you get much more energy that way. Some theistic religions preach a total surrender to an almighty being and to accept all things as the will of the Almighty. Would you consider this as a sort of letting go? That's a very sharp question. There is something very similar to that sort of surrender, because what you're actually surrendering, you're surrendering your will, your doer. It is a letting go. However, when you're surrendering to an almighty being, it's not quite the same. Because the reasons why you're letting go are completely different. It's almost like when you're letting go, in the way of Buddhism, you're letting go of everything. When you're letting go in this particular way, you're letting go of almost everything except your idea of a supreme being. Which means you can't go to the very end when you're still carrying around that idea. So in Buddhism, it's a big letting go. You're letting go of the whole lot. Letting go of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, in the senses, concepts. And you go into what those things truly are. Not as the words, but as their meanings. So that way that people actually who do that surrender, especially the Christian monks in the Middle Ages who did this full on. These days, no one really does that. They surrender to their idea of the Almighty Being, which is usually the pastor. That's the Almighty Being for them, or the Pope. But it's not really the Almighty Being within them. So because of that, they don't really get deep. But in the time of 400, 500, 600 years ago, some of the Christian monks would surrender so much that it looked like they did get into a jhana state. If one or two of them could do that. And you can see actually why that worked. They just gave up their will completely and they got inspired. They got incredible senses of joy and happiness. The ecstasy states. And there they got into these beautiful still states, which they identified as being a union with God. That's also part of the Hindu tradition as well. But I know what they say is a union with God to be like the first jhana. There's something deeper than that. It's still such a powerful state. If you had no other teachings, I could understand how theists would say, ah, yeah, that's union with God. It's just a powerful, selfless state. But it's more beyond that. Maybe if you want to ask more questions about that, especially after I talk about the jhanas and the insights. That's a very good question, and I really haven't got the time to go into it in full depth, but I'm going to cover many of those areas later on in the evening talks. Dear Ajahn, for the past 6 or 7 years, my daughter, now 26, has been dreaming of the dead, sometimes strangers asking for aid. Is there any significance? The last was just before the death anniversary of a friend's late grandma, whom she met only once. Thank you. Because usually when people dream, if they have recurrent dreams of a particular dead person coming to ask them for things, those are the ones I take seriously. If it's only a one-off dream, you dream of a dead person which you just met in passing, if it's only a one-off, I wouldn't take it seriously at all. It's just like your daughter there, it's just like a habit of her mind. She's got into the habit of dreaming that way now. It doesn't mean that it's true. Most of the dreams are just mind-made, concocted by our own mind. However, it's sometimes that you do dream of somebody, not just one night, two or three nights in a row. And then, it's quite likely that is that person asking you to do some good karma and share the merits for them. Those are the ones I take seriously. If it's just a one-off dream, I wouldn't take it seriously at all. If it recurs, yeah, then do something about it. Dear Ajahn, may I ask why I couldn't feel happiness, inspiration, although my mind is quite still? Nimitta has come out very early. I've been practicing good deeds and thoughts of loving kindness. Smiling wouldn't help. And what does Lord Buddha mean by taking out the arrow, straightening it, so I could only embrace it? Is there any other way? The way for you is patience. Happiness is coming, but when you look for it, when you want it, you'll never find it. If you're expecting these things to happen, if you want them to happen, it's called discontent. When we're talking about letting go, you have to let go 100%. 99% is never enough, it doesn't work. Completely abandon any hope for jhanas. Completely abandon any desire to get insight. Just be content in this moment, be peaceful, be still. Accept this moment as it is with loving kindness. The moment the door of my heart is open to you. Embrace it without any measuring or comparison. When you do that, because you're not doing things, you're not wasting the energy of the mind in doing this, going there, it's only a matter of time. It's just basic laws of science, the science of the mind. After a while, the energy of the mind will increase. The mindfulness will increase. You'll get this superpower mindfulness I talked about. It will happen. You just get out of meditation. Wow, look at that. The food for many of you is already beginning to taste more delicious. This is only the start. After a while, that food will be like gourmet. And it just happens naturally. Wait. And then the peace will give rise to joy, and the joy will give rise to tranquility, which will give rise to more happiness. It's the basic cause and effect relationship of the mind. So all you need to do is be patient. But the more impatient you are, wanting it to happen, why isn't it happening now? That shows expectation, discontent. That's actually why it isn't happening. You're putting it off. So be more content. Let go a little bit more. Don't try to expect anything. And then you'll find the happiness and the joy will just come to you. Remember someone like Ananda, trying all night to get into deep enlightenment. Never worked until he gave in. When he let go, then enlightenment came to him. Dear Ajahn, what should I do when my mind thinks too much? Okay. You take it out, put it aside, leave it in your room and then meditate. Wouldn't that be nice if we could somehow take out our brain, lift it up, take the brain out, so it can be nice, nice and quiet. Unfortunately that's impossible, unless you want a lobotomy, which is not a good idea. So if you think too much, never call it too much. It's good enough. So be kind to your thinking mind. That's number one. If you're kind to your thinking mind and you're at peace with it, and you're not trying to control it, you just think, it's wonderful that I'm sitting meditation. That's enough. I'm keeping 8 precepts. That's good enough. So don't want so much. When you don't want so much, you don't need to think so much. So when you don't need to think so much, the thinking will stop by itself eventually. So number one, please be content with your thinking mind. Don't beat yourself up or punish yourself. You know that story which I've been telling, that because my monastery's in the West, and because many of you have been conditioned by Western things, sometimes we do something wrong, we want to be punished. So I keep on telling my monks that you don't need to be punished. I keep on saying you're forgiven. And these days, when they do something wrong, I say you're forgiven for the 3 time zones. What does that mean? You're forgiven for everything you've ever done in the past. You're forgiven for everything you're doing now. And you're pre-forgiven for anything you ever do in the future. You're already forgiven before you ever do it. So you don't have to come to me and ask forgiveness anymore. I've already given it to you. Until the end of the eon. And that goes to each one of you. Whatever any of you in this room do, to me or to anybody else, I give you forgiveness until the end of this eon. So you've got a blank check, you can do whatever you like, you've already got my forgiveness in advance. You've got credit, unlimited. I mean that. Because that's what forgiveness truly means. Trust. But some of the monks, they wanted to get punished. They wanted to say, I can't meditate. And they punish themselves. So I decided one day to give them a penance. And being Australia, you know that when the convicts came to Australia over 200 years ago, the discipline was really fierce and very extreme. They didn't use a cane, they used a whip. And so I said, right, next time you misbehave, I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. And that's the local punishment now, Australian time. If any of the monks do any mistake, they get 50 strokes of the cat. You think that's being unfair? Being cruel? You know what I mean you know what I mean. Some of you heard me say this before. 50 strokes of the cat does not mean 50 lashes of a whip. 50 strokes of the cat means we've got a little modesty cat and you've got to stroke it 50 times. That's what I mean by 50 strokes of the cat. Stroke the cat 50 times. Because you need to learn compassion. So I sentenced them to have to stroke the cat, little Kit Kat, 50 times. So you can learn compassion. If you can learn compassion, then you can learn to forgive yourself. You don't need to be punished anymore. So that's actually learning to forgive yourself by the punishment of 50 strokes of your little cat in the house. So that, don't try and punish yourself. Your mind is not thinking too much. Your mind is thinking just the right amount. Congratulations, well done. It's just the right amount. So be at peace with yourself. If you can think like that, then after a while, just the thinking will stop by itself. If it's too much or too little, you're comparing, you're measuring, you'll never be able to stop thinking. And if you feel that really you've been lazy and you haven't done, you've eaten too much or you've slept too much, you haven't really been trying, if you need to be punished, then find the cat and stroke it 50 times. I sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat, or the dog, either will do. Some quite senior Buddhist meditation monks have this robe. Is this due to their karma, or is it because they had no contentment in their minds and not experienced the bliss of the jhanas? If such monks could not attain the bliss, peace of meditation, what about us lay people? How do we motivate ourselves to strive or in the light of such happenings? Thank you. Yeah, actually, you got it right, because monks disrobe because they don't get the bliss of deep meditation. That's the main reason. When you get contentment, there's no reason to ever want to disrobe again. You're having too good a time. The peace of meditation is just so lovely. A lot of times it is because the monks get too restless. One of the reasons is because some monks are forced to teach before they're ready to teach. So they end up teaching so many retreats, giving so many talks, they don't have time to meditate. They don't have time to develop their mind. That's why I keep my monks in my monastery under lock and key for many years before I let them go out, to make sure they're really strong inside before they go around teaching. Because you know, they're resources for our future. So I want to look after them and nurture them. It's just like when you have a little sapling, a little tree. It's in a nursery, it's protected until it's strong enough. You can plant it outside, but even when you plant it outside, you put a guard around it. And it's only when it's really established, you can take all the guard off and just let it grow naturally. That's what I, with our monks as well. As for you, you're very fortunate. You've got really great instructions. You're encouraged in the right way. Sometimes it's the instructions. These poor monks never have a chance to get a good teacher. I was just so fortunate in my life having a teacher like Ajahn Chah. It's just one of the best, if not the best. Now, masters. And be able to live with a monk like that was just incredible good karma. And it's not just what he said, but you saw the way he said it. And like, just one little teaching, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you disturb the noise. Wow, that's incredible, powerful teaching. You apply that to anything. It's not the thinking disturbs you, you disturb the thinking. Keep applying that. And then you find with a teacher like that, wow, you're really so far in advance, just having got a teacher who really can teach properly. So because I'm repeating some of those teachings of Ajahn Chah, you're just way ahead of everybody else. So you've got enormous chance of getting these deep meditations, enlightenment, the whole works. Some of my disciples in Perth have done all these things. It's amazing just to see that it actually works. They get blissed out and they come out afterwards, oh, Ajahn Brahm, it's so nice, it's so nice. I really get off on that. It's just so sweet when I get into deep meditation the first time. They're all sort of... The only thing you can compare it with, and it's not the best comparison, is when you see this young girl and young boy falling in love. You know what it's like when you see these little people and they're just in love for the first time. Oh, I'm in love. The whole world is wonderful and nice. They're crazy. But when you're meditating, when you get into meditation and deep meditation, it's just like the same. Oh, the whole world, just walking on air, you're floating. The whole world is just beautiful and lovely and you're having a great time. That's the nearest you can think about it, like falling in love. But it's much nicer than that. You just have this incredible, powerful experience. Your advice to observe noble silence. Does this also apply to reading Dharma books? Noble non-reading. No, you can read the Dharma books. Because actually it's quite useful when you're meditating. Because it's something which supports the meditation, which supports what's happening here. So yeah, read the Dharma books. Just don't read too many. Because sometimes you can read too much reading and not enough meditating. Ajahn Chah used to say, reading the Dharma books is like the sweets. You know the sweets at the end of the lunch? If all you ever eat is sweets, you're going to get very sick. So make sure you eat the main course first of all, you know, the rice and the curries. And once you've eaten the rice and the curries, then you can have a few sweets, but in proportion. So the main course is the meditation, the sitting and walking, that's the main course. The Dharma books you read is like the sweets. Great, you can, it's good for you, it's alright, but don't do it too much. Ajahn, can we dedicate the merits of our meditation to our family members, or should we share the merits or transfer those merits? Can they receive our merits? If so, please teach us how to do it. How long must we meditate in order to be effective? You can always share your merits. I like to do it with all sentient beings. Because with all sentient beings, that includes every possible being here. Not just my relations. They will get it because they're part of the sentient beings. And don't think if you share it wide, you're diluting your merits. So, you know, it's like sharing your money. If you give it to everybody, then no one gets very much. What actually happens is, the more you give, the wider you give, the more everybody gets, including yourself. So when you share merits to all sentient beings, whatever I've done today, may all sentient beings rejoice and share in the good karma I've made. You can do that any time you feel like it. It doesn't have to be at the end of the day. Just do it when you feel like it's appropriate. And also remember, it works in many different ways. First of all the people you're going to meet when you leave here, they will benefit from what you do in this retreat. Whatever peace, whatever kindness, whatever metta, whatever wisdom you grow will affect them. You'll be a kinder, more effective, more peaceful person, and that will rub off on everybody you meet. So whether you like it or not, you are sharing merits. Whatever merit you make today, even without thinking about it, would affect other people. You'll share it. I often thought of that when I was a young monk. However well I meditate, whatever insights I get, I know I'll be sharing with many, many beings. I'm sharing them with you now. This is my way of sharing my merits, by teaching, just by meditating. And you're doing the same. So it's powerful that we are connected in that way. And it's not just the beings you meet, some of the invisible beings as well. When you just think about these beings, they will know you're thinking about them, and they will come. And they can actually share the delight which you have, the happiness, the peace, the joy, the power you give to them. My deceased relations, this is what I'm feeling now. I give to you this peace, this happiness, this freedom. When you do things like that, those beings, they just get blasted with huge energies. If they're in the lower realms, they can't survive in those lower realms. The energy which you give them just shoves them way up into the heaven realms. When you understand the nature of the mind, you can only be in a low realm if you have a low mind. If you just give energy, happiness, bliss, purity to that mind, it just immediately just leaves that realm and goes to a higher realm. It just happens. Maybe I should get on with some more questions. Please explain the word mindfulness in simple words that can be understood easily. Is it similar to putting one's concentration onto something? Mindfulness, the real mindfulness, is effortless. Effortless. Full awareness of what's happening in the moment. The mind is full with this moment. Mindfulness. Too often we're only half awake, or we're half listening and half thinking of something else. We're not really fully aware. Let's call it mindfulness. So whatever's happening now, that fills your mind completely. No commentary. If you have a commentary, you're half talking, you're half listening. And that's not being fully aware. So when I'm speaking, you're just fully aware of the sounds. Not even trying to understand them, because that's too much effort. You're just soft like a sponge, and just absorbing everything which goes in. Fully alert, fully aware. Not controlling, not doing, not managing. just passively receiving the information of this moment. That's what being mindful is. And you experience the different levels of mindfulness, as I said in the first talk, of superpower mindfulness. After a while, just whatever you see with greater depth. Whatever you hear, even the sound of the traffic becomes like a symphony. Wow, did you hear that truck? Isn't that amazing? It's just like music. And the sound of the birds. That's being mindful. Joyfully present, fully alert and aware of what's going on. When you go into the mind, you see everything, you feel everything so deeply, so beautifully. That's what being mindful is. A couple of questions. Dear Ajahn, must the Buddha always be born a man? If so, is there any meaningful rational explanation other than what is quoted in the Buddhist scriptures? The Buddha is not a man, it's not a woman. Sometimes the Christians sometimes say that Jesus is alive, the Buddha is dead. And I've been telling the Buddhists now, I say, no, the Buddha's alive. And I quote a Buddhist statement to Vakali, that the one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. The one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. Can you see the Dhamma today? Is the Dhamma alive? Well, if you can see the Dhamma and the Dhamma's alive, you can see the Buddha and the Buddha's alive. So the Dhamma lives, therefore the Buddha lives. If you ever want a car sticker, put that on the back of your car sticker. The Buddha lives. Just being cheeky. But is the Dhamma a girl or a boy? So is the Buddha a girl or a boy? All you female yogis, have you got Buddha nature? Have only got the men got Buddha nature? It's interesting, this I'm going to tell you something from my experience, it's not in the suttas, from my experience of teaching meditation, the female yogis always do better in the samatha in getting deep meditation. You get into jhanas easily, more easy than the boys. You've got an advantage there. But, there's always a but, isn't there? Even though you can actually concentrate and focus the mind more, then the men, once they get into the jhanas, they can work it out much better. So they get the insight faster. So in the end, it all evens out. But the women usually get the jhanas more quickly. And you know why? It's because when you get deep towards the jhanas, these are emotional states. You get incredible, powerful blisses. When we talk about emotions, these are powerful ones. Incredible bliss and bright lights and beauty and strength. And those are the things which mostly that females are more easy to handle and to work on. They're not intellectual states, which is what the men are very good at dealing with. They're feely-feely states. If you know about how to use feely-feely states and are confident, which is allowing them to be, then you can get into deep meditation quite easily. The last stages of meditation are pure emotions of the mind. Just bliss, and you're working with bliss. So that's why you've got an advantage there, just to get into the jhana. So is the Buddha a man or a woman? Just neither. There's no reason why. It says this in the scriptures, but the Buddha said, don't believe the scriptures. So I'm not believing them. There's no reason why the next Buddha can't be a woman. And I stand up and say those things. I get into trouble by some other monks, but I'm on solid ground. Why not? It depends on what society. If the woman is respected, and has got equal power, equal rights. There's no reason why the being would not get reborn as a Buddha, as a woman. In the Jain tradition, the many of them, they call them Tirthankaras. Several of them were women. They weren't always men. Traditionally, there has been that equality there. So, who knows what the next Buddha will turn out to be? And also, who cares? Because we've already got a Buddha, and the Dharma is there. So don't wait around and see who it's going to be, a male or female. But who knows? I'm going to really stir people up now. Maybe the next Buddha will be gay. What did I say about I really stir people up? Ajahn, what's the difference between an insight and a mind chatter? Okay, the mind chattering, you never see anything through thinking. It's just, you just see the labels. What's the difference between the menu and the food? Insight is like tasting the food. Chatter is like reading the menu. Okay, so that's the difference between insight, which is tasting the food, and chatter, which is reading the menu. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it possible to teach a toddler to do meditation? If yes, how do we go about doing it? One of the great ways to teach a toddler is you to just sit down quietly on a seat and allow your toddler just to sit next to you. Because sometimes kids, we've done this before, that sometimes some of these parents in Australia, they've been meditating and their little toddler, just without them even saying what to do, they just come and sat down next to mum. And they just somehow tuned in to mother's energies. They just sat down there quietly, peacefully. Now afterwards they just got up afterwards. What have you been doing? Just being quiet. It's almost like a subconscious teaching the toddler how to meditate. And I don't know if any of you meditated at home, you have got a little cat or dog. Have you ever noticed that sometimes the cat just comes and sits next to you? The little dog does. Absolutely quiet, doesn't go sort of licking you or anything, just sits quietly. They pick up on your energies. And if you're very peaceful and quiet, your toddler gets peaceful and quiet. It's a great way of teaching little kids, even before they can speak, how to meditate. You can imagine this story, this is a true story about one of my disciples. She just gave him birth to a little baby, I don't know if it was a boy or a girl, forget now. You know what it's like, you know, when you just give them birth, you know, you've got your baby just on your chest there, like you're lying on your back, the baby's fed and just playing with it. And the baby, while the mother was on her back, and it was on its chest, the baby sat, crossed its legs in full lotus, put its hands together and started meditating on her chest. It was only about a couple of days old. Where the heck did it learn that? The baby went into full lotus, the perfect meditation posture, right on his mum's tummy. That's why he came to tell me, what's going on, Ajahn Brahm? It's quite obvious. Must have been a monk or a nun or meditated before. Just did it naturally, because it knew what to do. So sometimes your toddlers, they know already what to do. You just need to be encouraged. You just go there, sit down cross-legged, and they'll join you. They may even have better meditation than you have. They'll be teaching you. So I must apologize. These are the questions which I answered. These are the ones which still need to be done. So because of that, nobody can put any new questions in the box because I've already got enough from today. So I'll just leave these up here and I'll answer these tomorrow morning. So please, no more new questions in, otherwise we'll never get through them all. So great questions today. Thank you for asking them. Again, if I didn't answer them correctly, then put them down again. Because the worst thing I've always found myself, if you have the courage and you ask a good question and somehow I misunderstand what the question is and I don't answer it properly. If I didn't answer it properly, please write it down again so I can have another go. That's out of respect for you who asked those questions. Okay, so carry on meditating. Enjoy, don't try and get anywhere. If you're thinking, just be so content to be thinking that you're alive. Thank goodness I'm alive. thank goodness I'm free to be able to think. Don't have to worry about all these other things which I should be doing when I get home. Just enjoy the moment. Be content. Don't ask anything. Don't expect anything. Be content where you are, wherever that is. Get free, and after a while, and feel your way into the deep meditations. Allow those emotions. When you start getting happy, just allow it all to come up. If you're crying, if tears stream down your face, great, well done. Let them be. See what happens. See your answer. Or, and anyone wants to come for the interviews, I'll be down there in 5 minutes.